Well, it's recording.
Would you mind if I just made a quick announcement?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
When everybody's quiet, I'm just making an announcement about the next meeting.
Do it now.
Hi, can I get everybody's attention, please, for a second? I just wanted to talk about the December concentration meeting, which is the family violence concentration meeting. And just let everyone know that we're going to do it in a different format. We're going to have an informational fair on family violence. It's going to take place in the lounge area here. All my students in family violence are going to have booths that are in somebody's multimedia booths, interactive with lots of information and handouts and quizzes and all sorts of different things we're planning. So instead of sitting and listening to the talk, it'll actually be walking around and getting information from all of our booths. And we have someone coming from the NASA Coalition Against Domestic Violence as well to have a booth. So we really want to encourage all faculty and all the students to come and participate and learn as much as we can.
Will people be okay if we dim the lights a little bit?
Yeah.
Rather than move? So, hello, everybody. Welcome to the inaugural school psychology concentration meeting. Yes. All right. So thank you all for coming. I hope that we have a very enjoyable presentation for you. This past summer, I had a very interesting time, and so this is my report on what I did this summer. That's how I spent my summer. $6,000 later. This was funded by the Bank of Jeff Goodman. I have a co-presenter. It's my wife, Alita. Thank Goodman.
I didn't know anything yet, and I get applause.
Now, she made a cameo appearance.
That's what I understand.
In a student presentation yesterday by Shamshi. Very interesting. Interesting what you can find on the internet.
I'm going to be here.
So you all know about me and my credentials, perhaps, but you don't know about her credentials. So let me just read you about Belita. Belita Den Goodman is a second-generation librarian who previously served as the Associate University Librarian for Research and Instructional Services at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Much of her professional work revolves around understanding user research behaviors and the implications for information and research services. A New York City native, she previously served as head of the reference division at the Hunter College Library in New York, and as project director for the Malibu Digital Library Project in London, United Kingdom. Belita holds a master's degree in social work and a master's degree in information science, both from the University of Michigan. Her research interests are diverse and include user experience, that's UX, for those in the know, I guess, new uses of technology, information literacy, and rural libraries and literacy, which is what we're going to be talking about today. She's the author of numerous journal articles and has been published in academic journals such as New Library World, Libri, the Journal of Information and Knowledge Management Systems, and Reference and User Services Quarterly. Belita has presented her work at both national and international venues such as the Chinese Association for Information and Science in Guilin, China, the Online Information Conference in London, the American Library Association Annual Conference, the Ethnography and Education Conference, and the Pan-African Conference on Reading in Swaziland. Her first book was published earlier this year, and she's currently working on two additional manuscripts, one on the impact of rural village libraries in Africa, and the other on qualitative research in information science. And Lee is currently a doctoral student at the Palmer School of Information Science. PhD program, and her colleague Mercedes Yeoman is here from the Palmer School as well to take in what we have to present today. So, what we have for you is a smorgasbord of information comprising both Valita's previous research and what we did last summer in Uganda. So I just want to open up by reading a paragraph from a paper that I'm working on to set the tone for this research. By the way, this is also an advertisement for students who would like to accompany us to Uganda next summer to conduct additional research, longitudinal research. We also want to look at interventions teaching mothers how to read to their children. So anyone who has an interest in that, please see me. Yeah, and has their own budget, of course. We can foot the bill for room and board over there, but as far as vaccinations and the airfare, that's a little costly. But I already have one student who has an interest in going with us, Claire, who expressed an interest. So we got one possibly on board. One of the legacies of colonialism on the African continent is the widespread illiteracy and entrenched poverty that interfere with its people's full participation in the global economy. As of 1991, 54% of all Africans were illiterate. In some African countries, the illiteracy rate was over 90%. Africa is also the poorest region in the world and the only major developing region with negative growth in income per capita during 1980 to 2000. In sub-Saharan Africa, the average daily wage is 74 cents. The average life expectancy is 46 years. I'd be dead. While the average life child mortality rate, deaths per before the age of 5 per 1,000 live births is 172.5. Improvement in the literacy rate could provide the necessary conditions for an economic renaissance in Africa through mass dissemination of information that people could then use to produce goods and services in demand in other parts of Africa and overseas. The role of literacy in the functioning of the democratic process has also been noted. So that should set the tone for what we would like to accomplish. Libraries, rural community libraries, are being set up in rural villages all over Uganda and indeed in sub-Saharan Africa and other countries like Tanzania, Kenya, Burkina Faso, and Valia is going to go into more of that. I do want to hand out a copy of a brochure. This is the Uganda Community Libraries Association. You can actually participate. It's a nonprofit. You can contribute online if you'd like. And Valita also has a website talking about the Kitengese Library, which is the library we're going to be talking about specifically and where the research took place last summer. So, without further ado, I'm going to go to Valita.
Okay, so I'm Valita, as you all know. What I'm going to do is just give you a little bit of an overview about the work and the research that preceded the research that Jeff and I did this summer in Uganda. This is actually part of a series of longitudinal studies that started in 2004 when I was at Hunter College. And what we were looking at, we were operating out of the Kitengese Community Library. I don't know if the folks in the back can see this, but essentially it's a one-room cement building that was purpose-built in 2000. It cost about $1,700 to build this library.
the area that we were working in is extraordinarily rural. So no electricity, no running water, no paved roads. If you can see on top here, there are actually solar panels that we were able to install with a very small grant of like $1,500 that we got from the United Nations, and that allowed us to install solar panels in the library. But this is the library that was sort of the point of operations for all of the research that we did this summer. My own research actually started in 2004 when myself and a colleague wanted to investigate the impact that this library was having on this rural community. And we were looking at three specific factors. We were looking at impact on scholastic achievement, specifically of secondary school students. We were looking at impact on local economic development, that is, was the presence of this library and the use of this library in any way related to increased economic development in the area? And thirdly, we were looking at a factor called development of a reading culture. So, you know, Africa was largely colonized, and the concept of the public library as we know it was very much a British colonial institution, completely mistrusted by Africans. Africans and the native peoples were completely discouraged from using public libraries. These libraries were not meant for them. They were meant for the colonizers. And so over time, historically, what you have is a complete mistrust, number one, of printed materials, and number two, of the institution that, you know, we think is pretty harmless. I mean, libraries are relatively harmless here. That is not the case. And so what you have over time is that the library, and there are libraries, you know, in many of the African countries, but the materials are old, they're out of date, they're all in English, and they're not used by a majority of the population. So most of the native peoples on the continent do not have access to reading materials and resources that can really help them and help them improve their lives in any way. Thus, this movement of these rural village libraries that are built by the villages, they're owned by the villages, there's no governmental money involved at all, and essentially they're run by and for the people of the local community. And so that's sort of the concept that we're talking about when we talk about the rural village or community library. So it's not a system of libraries. They're individual, standalone libraries that are built just for those peoples. So this is the Kitangesa Library. And what I want to do before we get started talking about the research, this was Jeff's first time on the continent of Africa. And those of you who know my husband knows that he gets very excited about things that he's passionate about. And he just had a wonderful time. And the kids really gravitated towards him. And so I just want to show you a little video clip of Jeff sort of immersing himself in the culture, getting to know the people that we were going to be working with and so on. We really viewed this as sort of an ethnographic study because we were there, we were living in the community, we were immersed in what they were doing, we participated on every level, so it was much more of a participant observation than it was just sort of, you know, examining people under a microscope. So this is Jeff. You know, really a sort of an ethnographic case study of his time in Africa.
Oriotia! Yeah! Oh! Hello! Ah! How are you?
Ah!
Hey!
Yes!
Bunga!
Now, as you can see, these kids, this was in one of the villages that was even more rural, and these kids had never seen a Caucasian person before. And so what we don't show in this video is the kids, you know, touching Jeff's skin. They were fascinated with the hair on his arms. I mean, really, it was a very interesting cultural experience because you begin to understand just how isolated these rural communities are and how important it is. You know, these kinds of connections and this kind of exposure, I think, you know, from both directions, both on the part of the researchers and on the parts of the kids. But the kids were just, they were just
But wonderful. They do something we do over here. You know, Michelle and Barack Obama did the fist bump. You know,
it's very
got in trouble for that for some reason. But over there, they actually do that all the time, and it has a name. It's called Bonga. And so I was doing that with the kids.
And they all know how to do it. So you can do that, and they'll respond. So just a very, very
you're
brief...
You're a rapport builder.
Just a very, very brief overview of the previous research that's been done with the rural village libraries. Starting in 2004, myself and my colleague conducted three impact studies, 2004, 2005, and 2006, again looking at those three areas of impact that I described earlier. And Jeff and I are now in the process of conducting this longer intergenerational longitudinal study that we'll talk about today. I also spent time in Burkina Faso in West Africa in 2006 and 2007 and conducted a series of impact studies there. In Burkina Faso, which is on the complete other side of the continent, there are also probably about 7 or 8 of these rural village libraries that have been set up. And so I was looking at the same factors there. Burkina Faso is probably one of the poorest countries on the entire continent. Their Human Development Index, which is sort of a measure of life expectancy and quality of life, is extraordinarily low. I think they're like 169 out of 172 countries. So extraordinarily poor. And so we sort of had the sense that the impact of these libraries on things like scholastic achievement and local economic development would be even greater. So we wanted to examine that. I also participated in another impact study that was done in Ghana, again in West Africa, in two villages where we did surveys of students, again, about their use of the rural village libraries in Ghana. So very quickly, what did we find? And I'm not going to go through all of this because we want to get to the research that we did that's more relevant to you guys here. But essentially, we found some interesting things. We found that in terms of reading habits and literacy, there are some significant differences in terms of gender. Those differences very closely related to gender and cultural roles in the Ugandan society. So for instance, girls do most of the work. Girls starting from as young as 4 years old are responsible for going to the stream to get the water, which they carry back in the jelly cans on their heads. They have to do that 3 times a day, usually starting at about 5:30 a.m. in the morning, the last trip being at about 7 or 7:30. Whereas their brothers and male counterparts don't have to do any of that work. The boys essentially have much more free time than the girls, and therefore they tend to use that free time to read more. So they check out more books from the library. They also have more time to do leisure reading, whereas the girls don't. We also found that the students who used the library had higher class ranks than those who didn't, and that was sort of what we expected to find with that area of the study. In Burkina Faso, we found somewhat of the opposite. Burkina Faso, the students, and this also goes for Ghana, the students were much more concerned with using the library materials for their academic purposes only. Not as much leisure time was spent in these villages, and that has something to do with where these countries fall and sort of that human development index, that education is seen as much more of a vehicle out of poverty than in Uganda, which has a slightly higher developmental index, although Uganda is also extraordinarily poor, but not as poor as Burkina Faso, to be sure.
It's actually 154 on that Human Development Index.
So it's better than 169.
Right.
Okay, so now I'm going to turn it back over to Jeff. You're getting comfortable with
this. Yes, I was listening. Very intently. My first year class was I never did without my laser. Okay, so I guess earlier this year, I wanted to learn more about Valita's research and kind of immerse myself in it. And so she gave me a crash course, essentially, and she became my mentor in trying to find out what she's been doing for the last several years in Africa. So she assigned me a wide range of readings, including the articles that she had written, and I kind of read them through and kind of absorbed them. I mean, it's an area that I didn't know, I wasn't that familiar with. And I thought, okay, what's missing in what I'm reading? And what's missing, of course, is the intergenerational impact of these libraries. What impact, indirect as it might be, would a village, a community, rural village library have on the young children in these villages? And I asked Felita, has anyone done anything about the children, about their literacy acquisition patterns, anything like that? She didn't know of anything, and she's the expert in this area. So I said, well, why can't we do something about that? And I can participate, and we can do something together. And so that's how this project was born, out of me not knowing something and wanting to learn about it, and then reading all the materials and realizing, hey, I can make a contribution to the literature in this area. So this is our attempt at trying to do that. So we designed to test an intergenerational model of the mediational pathways of adult library usage on the development of a reading culture, improved literacy, and children's learning readiness following the establishment of a rural village library. And the library that we studied, of course, was the Kitengese Library in Masaka District in southeastern Uganda. We are hypothesizing that adult patterns of library use will positively impact the development of reading culture and support the development of enhanced literacy patterns among these adults, which in turn will predict their young children's development of learning readiness skills. Now, this actually was pulled from my IRB application. So this is what we were thinking of before we got there. This is what we wanted to demonstrate. So the idea being that adult library usage, okay, you got this library here, those people, those caregivers who use the library are going to have reading habits that are going to influence their family. They're going to read to their kids. They're going to instill in their kids the capacity to learn or to be ready to learn once they hit school age. And then in turn, the children's learning readiness skills will be improved. Now, we specifically chose children ages 5 to 7. Why is that? Because in Uganda, universal primary education, that's elementary school essentially, was not universal until 1997, but it is now. And I guess secondary education, middle school and high school, has just become compulsory or universal since 2007. Mm-hmm. Although I think many villages still don't have it, even though it's governmental policy now. The primary school children don't begin school until age 7. So I wanted to get a group of kids right before they hit the school age and see whether caregiver library usage might translate into reading to their children, which would in turn enhance their learning readiness skills. By the time they hit school, are they ready to learn? And is this a...
Yeah, that's a video. I don't know if folks are going to be able to see that in the back. Can you all see anything on the screen? A little bit? Okay.
Well, we could try it.
So this is just another really quick video clip. This is what it was like on the second day that we arrived when we were trying to get the research organized. Neither one of us speak Luganda, which is the native language of Uganda, and so we worked with translators the entire time. A lot of the people there do speak English. But the little children sometimes did not. So this is inside of the library on one of our first days there, just to give you a sense of chaos.
Moretti is one of our subject movement people. So we're trying to recruit these kids into the study. They're all reading.
They're pretending to read.
These are picture books. So let's describe the study a little bit. What we want to do is we wanted to look at three groups of people. Library users, those people who actually actively use the library, and these are caregivers of the 5 to 7 year old kids who were the target, the index children of this study. We wanted to examine mothers, caregivers who use the library, caregivers who lived in Kitigesa but did not use the library, so a sort of a control group, a comparison group, and then a third group of caregivers and 5 to 7 year old children. These caregivers we actually recruited from a village about 25 kilometers away called Gulema. And it's a long story how we made the contact. We had to meet a chief, and we had to give tribute of a bag of sugar. I
believe. 5 kilograms of sugar was the gift that we had to give to the chief of the village for his blessing to do our research there.
Right. So we went through all of that.
The IRB over there.
That was the IRB.
If only it were that easy.
Right. We had to tell him what we were going to do, why we were doing it. You know, he listened very intently. And the next time, so that was the first visit. The second visit, we came back with the sugar. And you remember what he said? He said, "You have done well." So we were in. So he actually helped us recruit the children and caregivers in that village. But that village did not have a library, was about the same size as Kitigesa, and was about 25 kilometers away. So none of these caregivers had any access to the Kitigesa library, because no cars, no horses. You walk or you ride a bike. That's how you get around. So we wanted a library or a community that had no exposure to a library. So we had these three groups. So one of the variables, one of the independent variables that we're looking at is level of library exposure. Now even the non-users in Kitigesa, we're assuming they're exposed to a reading culture which has been established in Kitigesa, even if they are not officially cardholders of the Kitigesa Community Library. As Valita demonstrated in her earlier work, there are all kinds of more indirect benefits that the community experiences as a result of having a library within your community. It's used by there are no school libraries, by the way. The school psychology concentration meeting, so I have to make it relevant. There are no school libraries in any of these communities. The one library that they use, that the students use, is the community library. That is the library. So it doubles as a school library. So the Kitigesa children benefit from this library. It's their school library as well as the community library. So there are a lot of benefits that we think to just having a library in your community. So we wanted not only to look at users and non-users, but also look at individuals, caregivers, and their children from a completely different community with no exposure to a library at all, and see if there are differences among these three different groups. So fortunately, we worked night and day, and we collected 51 caregiver-child pairs for the study, and the ends of the three groups were roughly equal, 16 or 17 per group. I have the exact numbers in one of the future slides. But so that was the design of the study. Valita and her sister Karen, who was one of our research assistants, came over and they administered a maternal interview, which was an hour long, and Valita's going to describe that a little bit. And then I'm going to describe the child measures that I used, and then we'll present the results and the findings. Yes, Kathy?
Two questions. Were all of the subjects literate caregivers?
No.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't like...
That was not a prerequisite.
Okay. And how literate are these communities generally?
Well, you know, this was Valita's first time in, it was our first time in Golema, and I think our general experience, and you did the maternal interviews, our experience with the literacy was much lower in Golema.
Yeah, it was, I mean, generally speaking, in rural areas, and most of Uganda is, most of the population lives in rural areas. And on the continent, the literacy rate as of 2007 for adults is right around 69%. For younger adults, it's probably closer to 80%. But those samples tend to be drawn from the urban areas. In the non-urban areas, you're really looking at literacy rates that hover like between 45 and 50%. And if you take a village like Golema, which is the second place that we went to that has no library and is even more isolated, those literacy rates really drop even further. So we found that many of the mothers in the maternal interviews in Golema didn't know how to read at all.
Some of them, honestly, some of them did not know how to write their name.
A lot of them didn't. They had to, you know, sign the consent.
Some of them didn't know their birthday. Many of them didn't know the birth dates of their children.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about isolation that it's hard to wrap your mind around it, really.
So I'll just describe the maternal measures very quickly. Each mother completed an interview that probably took us about an hour or so. The questions were designed to sort of ascertain the mother's reading habits, if there were reading habits, whether or not they could read, what they read, how often they read. One of the important questions really had to do with their reading interactions with their child. And so if they read to their children, how many hours per week they read, what they read, and then also whether or not they told their children stories. So, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about, you know, the public library really being sort of useless here. You know, Africa is pretty much, has always been an orally based culture, so that's their information exchange, and it's worked really well for them, you know, for as long as the continent has been in existence. And so a lot of those practices are still embedded in the communities. So we wanted to know whether or not the primary caregivers or the mothers told their children stories. And we found that overwhelmingly, you know, the answer to that question was yes. And some of the mothers, I mean, for those of you who have been looking at the DVDs, you remember that some of the mothers told us the stories. We asked them a yes or no question, and they proceeded to tell us all of the stories that they shared with their children. So the interview was designed to get at those kinds of questions. We were also trying to assess certain demographic characteristics so we could better assess their risk in terms of certain socioeconomic and socio-cultural risk factors. So things like whether or not there was a partner or a husband living in the home. Uganda is they have polygamous practices, so husbands will often have three or four or five wives. That means that any one of those households, you know, the husband is not going to be there all the time. So we wanted to find out, well, if he's not there all the time, how often is he there? That's a risk factor. Whether or not they had income or whether or not the primary caregiver was employed. So those were the kinds of questions we were asking at the end of the maternal interview.
Did you ask, you only interviewed the mothers, right?
Yeah.
Did you ask whether the fathers told stories or read to them?
We didn't ask that question specifically. Every now and then a mother would mention that they also, you know, the husbands or the fathers would sit in on the story time. But no, we didn't ask whether or not the fathers. It's usually maternal, but there are sometimes the grandfathers tell stories. Mm-hmm. Grandfathers and the great-grandfathers are the keepers of these stories sometimes.
Okay, so that's the maternal measures. Now, I'll get into the social contextual risk a little bit later, but just briefly, I have a developmental psychology background, and cumulative risk, according to Samaroff, is a key predictor of later socio-emotional competence and developmental outcomes. And so what I did was I culled the literature for some ideas about how to construct my own cumulative social contextual risk variable. And course, I had to modify it according to the cultural and socioeconomic needs of the particular population we were working in. So one of the indicators of risk was a variable that I called possessions. And I got this idea actually from one of Valita's colleagues, Michael Cavane, at UC Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. right? He has done a lot of research in Burkina Faso, and basically you add up the number of important possessions that that particular community might value. Oxen, goats, sheep, pigs, chickens. You have a cell phone. Believe it or not, there are no televisions, there's no electricity, but a lot of people have cell phones. Chrissy.
No, I'm just thinking I don't have cell, it wasn't a question, I don't have cell service at my house. How do they have
cell service? You need to go to Uganda.
Yeah.
They've got the 3G network.
That Verizon group.
I think, yeah, isn't it Verizon? It's the, who's the carrier?
No, it's like Uganda Mobile.
Oh, Uganda Mobile.
MTN.
Okay.
Uganda
Mobile. MTN. So they got better service than we do.
But the towers are in the urban areas, and so if you're like 10 miles or whatever from like an urban center, then chances are you can get cell phone reception in the village. But the second village that we went to in Gulema, that was not the case because there was no cell towers to be had. They were not close to an urban area, so it's hit or miss.
Yeah. Another interesting indicator of risk was whether you have a cement floor or not in your home. A lot of the homes that we visited, we did a lot of visiting, some of the homes were actually made of soil, earth. I had never seen that before. That blew my mind. I mean, they're actually made of soil and thatched roof and dirt floor. And so actually in the spilled juice story, in the attachment story completion task, you know, when the little girl, Naka, spills her juice, and you say, show me what happens now, sometimes the juice seeps into the ground. There's nothing to clean up.
Right, right.
I've never heard that story ending before over here. It just doesn't seep into the ground over here. But so a cement floor becomes like a status symbol. So that was another indicator that we included in our variable in trying to understand socioeconomic differences among the various dyads that we looked at. Okay, so I worked with the kids and we completed 5 tasks that I believed would measure learning readiness. And I selected these tasks specifically to avoid any kind of reading, any kind of large receptive vocabulary needed. I wanted to keep it as simple as possible. These, and I believe that most of these tasks fit that bill. Now, with the exception of the Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test, I bought this $300 PPVT Ford, brought it over there, and you know, after the first administration, we knew this wasn't going to work. I hadn't translated it, and I had assumed that our translators would have sufficient English vocabulary skills to be able to just translate on the spot, and that just didn't work, and they were giving hints to the kids. And.
But the other thing, that there were some very interesting cultural lessons. The other thing was that some of these images in the Peabody vocabulary test, there was no word for in Luganda. Mm.
Yes.
So Eskimo, right. There's no word for that. You know, and yeah, so our translators were struggling to try and create, to cobble words together. And Jeff, you know, was saying, well, you know, you can't do that. It has to be an exact translation. So it became very clear, because there are a number of issues with that, that because of cultural reasons, not anything to do with the kids, we couldn't use that particular measure.
So this is a lessening cultural sensitivity.
Yeah.
We learned the hard way. Mm-hmm. So I stopped administering that after the first kid. So we're down to 4, and the other 4, you know, worked fairly well. Now, how did I come up with these, and what are these tasks? Okay. Larry Aber and Joe Allen, 1987, published a very pivotal paper on learning readiness skills. And they looked at a group of maltreated children ages 4 to 8 and with varying socioeconomic levels. And in that study, they administered 10 very novel tasks. Actually, it had been administered by Ed Ziegler, who is at Yale. He's a co-founder of Head Start. I think we have Yuri Bronfenbrenner here, don't we? Who is another co-founder of Head Start, right over there. Anyway, he factor analyzed his data, these 10 tasks, and 4 of them loaded onto a factor called the secure readiness to learn in the company of unfamiliar adults. And these 4 tasks, these first 4, were the tasks that loaded onto that factor. And I said, that's the factor we want to examine in these kids. We want to see where they have a secure readiness to learn in the company of unfamiliar adults. When they go to school, it's called P1, at age 7, are they going to be ready to learn or are they not? So the first one's called the Marble in the Hole game, the second one, Pictorial Curiosity Task, the third is the Box Mazes, and the fourth was the Peabody. As I said, we did not administer the Peabody after the first subject, but the other 3 we did administer, as well as the Attachment Story Completion Task, which I'll talk about in a minute, but I just want to show you some of the materials. The Marble in the Hole game, now what you have is a wooden box, and I want to personally thank Dustin Cahoon, who worked very tirelessly this summer on these materials to get them ready for me, and he did an outstanding job. This wooden box has 2 holes. Has 2 holes in it, and you tell the child to put the blue marbles in the front hole and the gray marbles in the back hole. Okay? And they can stop whenever they want to. And this is timed, so they get 10, it's 2 10-minute trials. Now, why would this be important? Why would this be interesting? Actually, what Aber and Allen found in 87 is that the kids who took the entire 10 minutes to do such a rote, simple, repetitive task are trying to please the administrator. There's no motivation for doing it, people. It's not fun. It's boring. So why are these kids still doing it? And believe me, there were plenty of kids who actually spent the entire 10 minutes, both trials, 20 minutes. The first trial is the blue marbles in the front hole and the gray marbles in the back hole. The second trial is the gray marbles in the front hole and the blue marbles in the back hole. And some of these kids, they're just troopers. They're just doing it because they want so badly to please me. You know. So this is a measure of dependency. So this loads negatively onto the factor of secure readiness to learn, learning readiness skills, okay? So that's the first task. The second one is a pictorial curiosity task, and I modified this along with Dustin for our trip. Essentially, you're supposed to have 12 different houses for 12 different trials, and I couldn't get that in my duffel bag. So Dustin actually came up with a very novel way of creating one house, but using 12, still having the 12 trials. So what this is a house, and on the left door is a picture. On the right door is blank. Now, we show them the first trial, okay? Behind the door with a picture is another picture exactly the same. Same thing. Behind the blank door is a picture you've never seen before. So basically, the kids have to choose each time which door they want to choose to look at.
You got it.
Light bulb went on. So the kids who choose the blank door are more curious. Hence the term pictorial curiosity. They're more interested in what's behind the blank door than looking at the same old picture on this door. Now you think, well, what kind of variability would you get from that task? All the kids are going to choose the blank door.
No.
Aha! That's not the case. There was a lot of variability. It was unbelievable. I was shocked. I didn't think this was going to work, actually. Yeah. But it worked beautifully, and actually of all these tasks, we haven't coded the attachment data yet, but of the three tasks that we did code, this one is the one that was the strongest as a dependent variable for our equation, our statistical equation. So this is very interesting.
What do you instruct the children when you give them that?
What do you tell them? Just what I basically said.
What?
That you choose whichever door you want.
And but you don't say there's something inside each one.
No, we tell them that behind the door with a picture on it is a picture exactly the same.
Oh, you tell them?
Yeah, okay. We tell them.
Okay.
There are no surprises, yeah.
Okay.
We tell
okay.
them, this is the trial, this is the first trial. There are 13 of these, or 12 trials, there are 13 because okay. one of them is just an example to warm them up to the task. So we tell them, we show them behind the door with a picture is a picture exactly the same. And this is all being translated by our two translators. Okay, behind the blank door is a picture you've never seen before.
And
we say, you know, choose the door you'd like to open. And we do this 12 times with 12 different sets of pictures. And you wouldn't believe the variability that you get from that. Unrelated to age. Age did not co-vary with this. So, then the third task. So that measures pictorial curiosity. And the third task is the box maze task. And this measures variability seeking. Now this is, we have an artist who produced this. Help the monkey find his way up the tree to get the bananas. So we made it culturally relevant. We have this monkey here who has to get to the bananas. So they have to draw a path to the bananas. Now there are five different ways you can go, and actually there's actually many more ways because the paths intersect. So what would this measure? We give it five times, same exact, just on different colored paper, same exact maze, photocopy, five times. What do you think this might measure? Of the administrator or the child?
Also, the attempt to try new.
That's it.
Like you could find one way and then do the same thing each time, right. Or you might say, well, okay, I did it that way, now let me try a different way.
She's a ringer. Yes, it's basically measures variability seeking. How much do these kids seek out variability in their learning and exploring, right? So this is the mazes. So we looked at these three variables. Okay. So let's dim the lights. We're going to show a little bit about how this actually works. We found a sequence that I kind of liked, and what I just demonstrated, we'll just show a little bit of snippets of each one. Okay, this is Marble in the Hole.
This is the game called Marble in the Hole.
This is our train. Oh, that's too bad. You know, on the screen it looks great. This is our translator, Sewa.
Some of them are blue. And some of them are gray. They call me holes. The blue ones go in the front hole. And the gray ones go in the back hole. Now show me the blue marble. Now put it in the hole where it goes.
Jimmy means good job. I learned one word.
Where is that? Okay, you can put in as many more holes in the holes as you want. You tell me when you want to stop, and we will play a new game.
He's just repeating instructions. There's my stopwatch. So you can see that you get the idea. This goes on for 10 minutes.
You said 2:40, so that's basically.
Every 10 drops, you reinforce with a good job, Kalunji. Every 10, you reinforce. And some of these kids will just do it ad infinitum, yes.
You said this correlated negatively with school readiness?
Yes, negatively.
Negatively.
Yes.
That they would
it loads program. Negatively onto the factor of secure readiness to learn. The longer the time, the less ready. Correct.
Really?
Yes. Jennifer.
Do you think that the fact that you're administering the test, kind of a novel person, would maybe affect their desire to please you rather than if someone, even a stranger, but someone from their own community administered?
Well, it would have to affect them all the same, and it didn't. We clearly got individual variation. Mm-hmm. So none of them or few of them had seen a white person, but only some of them were responsive to all 20 minutes. They maxed out on the time trials. I was very surprised. But
is there a ability that their desire to please could affect them in the classroom if they want to please the teacher?
Yeah.
Listen more. I'm just curious.
Absolutely. But would that hinder or foster their learning?
I would say foster.
We don't please our teachers a lot. We try. It's different.
So we're a little bit.
In grad school, we foster dependency.
We're giving more models.
Yes, in grad school, we foster that dependency.
Also, seems like persistence would also be a positive.
But it's so repetitive and so simplistic.
For some of them.
Exactly.
But I mean, it is to us because we're a very short attention span culture. Their culture is more with more tests and something else.
Well, that is definitely true. It's a good point. Actually, of all these kids, and I assessed, I did all 51 kids, and the entire administration took a little over an hour for each kid. Right, these are 5 to 7 year olds. Out of the 51, only one took a bathroom break. There was no ADHD.
Yeah. They sat.
Okay.
Their interviews were actually longer than
yeah.
an hour.
Oh, yeah.
They're closer to an hour and a half, and these kids sat the entire time, even the 5 year olds. It was amazing. Just
that in itself.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No ADHD.
But that's cultural. That issue is completely cultural because you see them with their parents and their caregivers, and there's very much the sense that, you know, what I'm supposed to do is to sit, be quiet, do what I'm told. And, you know, I think that some of these measures that Jeff was doing, you know, there was very much the question about whether or not that would hinder their learning in the classroom. If there's this rigidity and this sort of inability or this fear about exploration and creativity, you know, that's a question. But again, I think your question is an important one because maybe that's a cultural difference, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, we see that a certain way because we're from the West, but, you know, who's to say? So, you know, a lot of those culturally relevant questions also came out of this research.
Absolutely.
You want to talk about the PASCO syndrome?
Yes, we'll talk about the PASCO syndrome. Another unintended learning experience was the fact that we didn't expect so many mothers to be so desperately want to participate in our study. We had people come, I mean, how many of you are going through your dissertation, you're struggling to get subjects? I mean, you know, it's a real problem. Who wants to spend the time to do that? These mothers would walk a mile to participate with their kids.
They would wait for hours.
They would wait for hours to participate. And we actually had some lying. We had very strict guidelines about the age, obviously 5 to 7. The problem was around part. Some of the mothers didn't know the birth dates of the kids. Some of them didn't even know the year in which the kid was born. And then there were mothers who just, we know they outright lied to us about the age of the kid. So we just wanted to show a little humorous clip of a mother who so pleaded with us to allow her child to be in the study.
We called it the Pasco syndrome because this kid's name was Pasco. And it's something that we experienced again and again, so it actually was a real, real factor.
Did they get a compensation?
Not really. I mean, we gave them something to eat, books and lollipops for the kids.
They got something anyway. No, no. So this is the marvel in the whole game of trying to do this with the mom being.
Now watch the kid. Does he look 5? So the translator said he doesn't understand anything.
She's trying to do it for him.
She's taking his hand and trying. Please, just, you know. And he doesn't understand. He's too young.
Look, she's...
So now we're trying to figure out, is the age really what the mother said? She's still trying. She's desperately trying.
It's just not going to work.
I let this go on too long, but I felt so bad.
So explain
that.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
He's too young.
Now he likes the marble.
So I give him a book and a lollipop anyway. But Kristen.
Why do you think it is that mothers are so desperate?
Well, that was Danielle's question.
Oh,
yeah, I think they, in their minds, they felt that there was some prestige,
yes,
that was associated with working with us from the West, from the United States. There was some prestige involved. I also think that, I mean, a lot of them believe in superstition and providence and you know, if they somehow are associated with us, good things are going to happen to them.
Or that somehow the testing was going to help their children. I think that that's what a lot of them also thought, that testing was somehow going to, you know, help their children in some way.
So. In Gulema, we actually worked with a grandmother and who was a primary caregiver and a child, and after we were finished, the grandmother pulled us all together, the research team, and said, you know, I know God has brought us together, and that this is a very important moment in our lives, and we know that you're going to build us a house. And, you know, what do you say to that? So you want to talk about conditions?
Okay, just quickly before Jeff gets to the actual results of the study, so what we found. We did some things in addition to looking at the children and the mothers. We also supplemented that by running a number of student focus groups. These were with students ages 13 through 17, groups that used the library and groups that didn't. And we also did adult focus groups with community users from the library, again, looking at library impact in general.
By the way, let me just go back. These focus groups, I actually co-led these groups with Belita. Belita did the student groups. We used Auerbach and Silverstein's qualitative research model. And so I asked them three questions. How has the library impacted you as an individual? How has the library impacted you as a family, in your family? And how has the library impacted your community? They were an hour long, and we conducted five of them. And Jason knows them very well now, because he's actually transcribing them. But actually, these data are open to people who want to do dissertations with this research. These are data we collected because we thought we could do something with it or have a student do something with it. So that's dissertation data for people. You don't even have to be in the school psychology concentration. Okay, so this is the mediational model that we wanted to test with the data. This was basically a variation on the original mediational model that you saw earlier in the presentation. That's level of library exposure. So you have the three groups, the library users in Kitengesa, the non-users in Kitengesa, and then the Golema individuals who don't have access to a library. Would impact on the child's learning readiness, as we've already defined and talked about, mediated by the number of hours per week a caregiver reads to the child. Now, we collected a lot of data that could serve as a mediating variable between these two variables. I went for the more quantitative frequency of reading to the child, but we also collect a lot of qualitative content oriented. What do you read to the child? Those kinds of data. I got these data, my research team has been working night and day on this project so that I could be ready for today. And Jennifer Meter, thank God for her. Where is she? She got it to me Saturday night. So what you see, it has been done since Saturday night. So that was the mediation model, but we wanted to assess some other models as well. A moderational model, in which number of hours per week the caregiver reads to the child and cumulative social contextual risk and the interaction between these two predicts child learning readiness. We thought that, we know from other research, for example, Aber and Allen, Belsky and Fearon 2004, that cumulative risk and Bernstein and Hans 1994 predicts all kinds of developmental outcomes, socio-emotional competence, etc. We wanted to see whether maybe number of hours a caregiver reads to a child might moderate or buffer the child from the cumulative risk that he or she might be experiencing in their immediate environment. Keep in mind, all these families are high risk because poverty is widespread, but there are individual differences in socioeconomic and risk impact. So we wanted to find out whether perhaps hours a week read to the child might moderate this risk factor here on learning readiness. And the third model is, of course, the additive model, level of library exposure and hours per week and cumulative social risk predicts learning readiness. Descriptive statistics, the age of the child, 5 to 7, the mean was 5.92, we had 49% males. Hours per week read to the child was 2.16. Cumulative risk, before I summed the cumulative risk factors together, I standardized, so we added together z-scores, so that's why the means are 0. You see the standard deviations, the minimum and the maximum there for contextual risk and learning readiness. Now we look by level of library exposure. So the Kitagisa users is group 1, Kitagisa non-users group 2, and the Golema non-users, which they're all non-users, is group 3. So you can see here that the number of hours read to the child dropped very much here, although it was not quite significant. Social contextual risk, you can see that the Kitagisa library users had the lowest risk, followed by actually the Golema non-users, and then the Kitagisa non-users with the highest risk. So 1, less than 2, and 3. And child's learning readiness, we found that the Kitagisa users had the highest learning readiness, followed by the non-users, and then way behind are the Golema non-users. So 1 and 2 were significantly different from 3. Now, let me just ask you, why would you think that possibly the risk was much lower in the Kitagisa library users than in the non-users of the other two groups? Any ideas?
Status?
Of
like the families or whatever.
So let me rephrase that.
Please.
So you're saying that if you were in a lower risk family, caregiver, perhaps you're more likely to reach out and use the library. Yes, correct. Any other thoughts about it? That's one explanation. How about the library having an impact? Is it possible that if you use the library, you're going to read about new farming methods, you're going to read about health, ways of keeping you and your family healthy, right? And that's going to lower your risk, which is going to put you in a lower risk category. That's another explanation of the data. Child's learning readiness. The Kitagisa children, regardless of whether their parents were users, had higher learning readiness scores than the non-users. Why might that be the case? Any thoughts? Chrissy?
With the literate culture, and that's the basis of
exactly. So perhaps, whether you're a user or non-user of the library, you live in Kitagisa. It has a library. That library has a diffuse impact on everybody living in that community, not just the users of the library. As Valita's earlier research has documented, there are some more global impacts that the library has, or benefits that the library has for the entire community. No. In the old-fashioned colonial libraries, all the books are in English. In these rural village libraries, such as the one in Kitagisa, there's a mixture of both English and Luganda books. Sure, absolutely. That's more along the lines of Kathleen's explanation. So, exactly, there are these dual explanations for the data. I mean, obviously the data are not causal. They're just correlational. We couldn't randomly assign people to these groups. So what are the correlations among these various variables? Basically what I just said, this is learning readiness. You'll see here that learning readiness, user status is The kit against the users versus the non-users, not significant. But the village status, whether you're in Gulema versus Kitigesa, the Kitigesa kids were much more learning ready than the Gulema kids. For risk, you'll see here, these are the two interesting correlations, that if you're a user of the library, you have lower risk than if you're not a user, regardless of whether you live in Kitigesa or Gulema. Okay. For village status, hours per week, it was a trend, p less than 0.10 for village status. If you lived in Gulema, the caregivers were marginally reading less to the kids than if they lived in Kitigesa. We think that's because of the library. Now, if we had a larger sample, I'm convinced that would be significant. But we only had 51. We only were there for 2.5 weeks. So these are the social contextual variables. I broke it down into all the variables. Children under, how many children you have under 6, the mother's age at the time of their first birth, the possessions, we talked about the possessions, goats, chickens, cement floor, etc. Educational level, whether they're employed or not. Health, this is a very interesting indicator. We asked these mothers to rate on a 3-point scale their self-reported quality of medical health. From 1 is poor, to 2 is moderate or fair, to 3 is good. And would you believe that that really had a very powerful impact? Look at this. User status. If you use the library, you tended to rate your health as much higher than if you didn't use the library. Also, if you were healthier, if you rated your health as better, you spent more hours a week reading to your kids. Interesting. Other risk factors, well, we would assume that would be highly correlated. Learning readiness. If you as a caregiver tended to rate yourself more highly on this health scale, your child would be more learning ready. We hadn't anticipated that health, self-reported health, would be such an important factor. Who knew? I threw it in there because I worked on a study back in the early 90s in which we used a similar scale on a different study that I did in Newark. I didn't realize it would be that powerful, but in hindsight, we think back to our experience, and a number of these mothers were HIV positive. They looked like, you know, they were at death's door, a lot of them.
Yeah.
So, what impact would that have on a child coming into the world and trying to learn and explore their environment? Are they going to be as likely to do that? Are the mothers going to be invested if they're sickly to read to their kid, to engage in their child? Are they going to be more depressed? Now, we didn't administer a depression inventory, but we know that depression and self-perceived health are correlated. So when we go back, we'd like to explore a lot more about these health issues. Social support, we measured that. We asked the caregivers to name 3 names of someone who could give them a loan, someone who could take care of their kids in an emergency, and someone they could confide in. So the scale is from 0 to 9. Social support. Relationship, whether they have a partner living with them or not, income, and quality of relationship. We ask them to rate the quality of their relationship that they're in on a scale from 1 to 3, similar to the health rating. Yeah.
Mom at first age of first birth, it looks like the older the mom, the less library exposure, but the older the mom, the better the learning readiness.
Well, these are non-significant
correlations. Am I reading the direction right?
The direction is...
The older the mom... Exposure. Right?
No, actually, we coded the data. Kitigesa users is 1, Kitigesa non-users is 2, and Gulema non-users is 3. So it's actually the Kitigesa users are just slightly older. Okay. This level of library exposure is reverse coded. I know it's a little confusing.
Okay. So there must be a reverse coding on the quality of relationship at the bottom.
Right, exactly. So they rated their quality of relationship slightly higher than the non-users and the dilemma caregivers. Correct. But this is, yes, this is, I was astounded. The older the mother, when they had their first, not necessarily the target child, but their first child, whoever that might have been, was the older they were when they, so if they waited to have their first child, the target child would be more likely to be learning ready. So if they hold off having kids, their children seem to be better off for it, at least on this particular variable that we studied. These are the learning readiness variables. The one that really stands out here is the pictorial curiosity, the house. You'll see that there was a strong negative correlation, which means that the Kitten Gesa users, those kids were the most pictorially curious. User status also negative, meaning that the users versus the non-users, non-users being both Kitten Gesa and Gulema non-users, the users were more curious, the children of the users were more curious, and the village status, whether you're in, it doesn't matter whether you're in, whether you're a user or a non-user in Kitten Gesa, if you just look at the Kitten Gesa children versus the Gulema children, the Kitten Gesa children are much more curious. And we would like to attribute it to the fact that Kitten Gesa has a library, because if you look at these two communities, they're virtually identical except for the fact that one of them has a library. So this is what we found. The mediational, moderational models didn't work out for us. But this, I tested an additive model, library exposure, risk as measured by that health variable that I pointed out, and learning readiness as measured by the pictorial curiosity. If you just pick out, if you cherry pick, you know, these two variables out of the total risk indicator and the learning readiness, you find that you have an equation that explains 23% of the variance, p less than 0.01. The beta here is 0.05, and the other beta is 0.05 as well. So we did find that these independently predict pictorial curiosity. Okay. Summary of the findings. Cumulative social contextual risk is positively correlated with level of library exposure, specifically library user status. Here are the two explanations. Caregivers with less risk were more likely to be a library user. That's Kathleen's explanation. The explanation I'd like to believe is that library usage, for example, reading about health, reading about farming methods, reduces your risk. Okay? Second summary of finding.
Jeff, how many years has the library been in place?
Since 2001?
Yeah, since 2001.
Also, already a lot of years that it could have had an impact.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Exactly.
8 years worth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Learning readiness was negatively correlated with level of library exposure, specifically village status. So whether you lived in Gulema or Kitten Gesa, there was a big difference in the children's learning readiness. Two explanations. The absence of a community library in Gulema reduced learning readiness of its children. That's what I'd like to believe. Another explanation is that Gulema just has a lower literacy rate than Kitten Gesa. However, why would it have a lower literacy rate? No library. Either way, I win on that one.
Pretty much.
So we also learned that caregiver self-reported quality of health was positively correlated with learning readiness, specifically pictorial curiosity. Explanation. Mm-hmm. Healthier caregivers were more responsive to the child's emotional and cognitive needs, essential for the development of learning readiness. Caregiver self-reported quality of health was negatively correlated with level of library exposure, specifically library user status. So if you're using the library in Kitten Gesa, you have higher, you're rating your health more highly. Two explanations, library usage, like reading about health tips. There's a lot of medical health books in the Kitigisa Library. Improve the caregiver's quality of health. Or caregivers who felt better about their health were more likely to be library users. Kathleen's
explanation. The bad guy.
No, that's good.
No, you thought it was. Both village status and caregiver self-reported quality of health independently predicted children's pictorial curiosity. Exposure to a community with a library and having a healthy caregiver improved children's confidence to explore and understand the world around them. Some readings. This is the research team. That's Julius. Some of you know Julius very well because you're coding or transcribing the interviews. It's me and Valita. This is Sewa, our other translator, and this is Karen. This is Valita's sister, who also assisted with the maternal interviews. That's our team, minus Goretti, who was subject to improvement. She couldn't make that photo. Here are some people who were very important in helping us out. I want to material design, Dustin Cahoot. Thank you, Dustin. The maternal interview transcription, we've had a lot of first years involved. Jennifer Anderson, Jennifer Gorman, and Jennifer Meter, the three Jennifers. Maria Adjua, Jason, and we have some future applicants here, Cheryl Mann and Stephanie Pogan, and then some work study students, Victoria Green, Tracy Sullivan. The coding of the maternal interview and the data entry, Jennifer and Stephanie Pogan, again, this couldn't happen without them. So we wanted to end by showing a little clip of one of the children. Okay, this is a child who is he's completing the attachment story completion task. And one of the stories is the departure story, where the parents go away on a trip overnight, and they're left with their grandmother. And you say, show me what happens now. So they're all alone with the grandmother while the parents are away. You said the parents come back. I said, not yet.
He says we are going
to read books. Is it a coincidence that his caregiver is a library user? What? Reading a book. Okay, questions?
You didn't mention the attachment
task.
Hasn't been coded. Oh, okay. The attachment story completion task is a series of five story stems, attachment activating story stems, that you act out with a family of dolls, mother, father doll, boy and girl, and then the grandmother comes in for the departure story. There are five story stems, and the child, after telling the stem, which poses a central conflict for the child related to attachment, the child has to finish telling the story, so it's semi-projective. So you say, show me what happens now, and the child has to finish telling the story. So the first story is the spilled juice story, involves confrontation with the caregiver, you spilled your juice. Sometimes it seeps into the ground. Hurt knee story, they're out walking in the hills, and the target child climbs a rock, falls, hurts his knee. Show me what happens now. Third story is the monster in the bedroom story. Child goes to bed, screams, there's a monster in my room, there's a monster in my room, show me what happens now. The departure story, the parents go away on an overnight trip, grandmother comes to take care of them, show me what happens now. And then the reunion story is the fifth story, the parents come back from their overnight trip, show me what happens now.
I'm just wondering if you had to change this at all culturally. Yeah. You said in the hills, and that one wasn't...
Exactly. So in the original American version of these stories, they're walking in a park. There are no parks. Okay, you're in the jungle. Okay, so we had to change it to hills. So they're out walking, because it's hilly. So they're out walking in the hills, and the kid climbs a rock and falls, hurts his knee. So we had to make certain changes like that.
And their names also, Naka and Seka, are very common Ugandan names that referred to the child's placement in the family. So yeah, definitely we had to make changes to that.
Now, these stories, incidentally, could be used for all kinds of qualitative analysis. What we learned, interestingly, these are 5 to 7 year old children now. There are a lot of tasks that they do in these stories. They do digging. They dig vegetables and tend gardens. They cook food. These are 5 to 7 year olds. But guess who does it? Guess who does all the work in the family?
Naka.
Naka, did she serve tea? Naka did everything.
She cleans, and she's fine. Yeah.
And it didn't matter whether it was a girl telling the stories or a boy. Naka was always the one doing everything. I mean, I was shocked.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be.
What do the boys do?
No, a lot of the boys told stories where they would like do the digging.
They would do some sometimes.
They would do some digging and stuff like that. But the girls would be the ones serving the tea, washing the dishes, cooking the food. I mean, they're doing left and right and. At some point, the translator and I would just like bust out laughing because it was just so obvious that, you know, Naka's getting the short end of the stick.
Two quick questions. Yeah. One, did you put that in because you had hypotheses about attachment security?
We didn't talk about that much.
Is that one of your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do was to look at that as a form of learning readiness, because attachment is a broad indicator of socio-emotional competence. However, we're in the process, I mean, I just threw this together. We're still transcribing. You have to transcribe these interviews, actually. And then they have to be sent out for coding. And
so
it's a little bit more complicated than this.
So you're transcribing what the translators said?
Yes. Ask my students.
Not easy.
So you're doing a double translation from English to the Ugandan language?
No. We're just the transcribers are only transcribing what they hear in English. But it could be spoken by the translator, could be spoken by me. It's not spoken by the child. The children didn't speak English.
Since you couldn't randomly assign, so we don't know if it's differences intrinsic to the people who choose to use the library, or even baseline differences between the villages are possible, although you have no good reason to think that. But I know you're going back. Is your plan to do prospective work to see longitudinally if the kids, even in the non-users perhaps, but in the town with the library, have a whole different trajectory?
Absolutely.
In the town without the library?
That's our plan.
It seeps into the culture, and they
that's our plan.
Differentially gain that. Will you go back a few times over years?
And I'm hoping to take students with me. This
so
golden
like
opportunity.
Your perspective or even
no multiple. We're there for the long haul.
Yeah.
I mean, ideally, we'd like to follow these kids like through secondary school. Secondary school is usually the point where the school leaving happens because they just can't afford to continue, and so. You know, if we can determine that these kids who were the most learning ready, you know, actually were able to get to secondary school and then beyond, and maybe even look at scholastic achievement, I mean, there's something there. But it's a longitudinal, long-term study, most definitely. I mean, this just gave us more questions.
I also want to address your interesting question about the intrinsic differences between these two communities. It's something that
and between the ones within it who use it versus
exactly. Now, you could make the argument
Catholic stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, being Catholic and stuff.
you could make the argument that there's something intrinsic, there's something about the Kinta Gesa community that gave rise to a library that that spark, for whatever reason, wasn't there in Gulema. The argument against that argument is that a lot of these rural, most of these rural libraries, at least this is Kevane's argument, most of these rural libraries, they are funded and started by benefactors from outside the community. Kinta Gesa is it's not. Exactly. It's really happenstance. It's random. It's arbitrary. The library in Kinta Gesa was founded by a former villager who, through his own, I guess, talents, but also serendipity like us all, he made it to the big city, Kampala, and got a college education, actually got a doctorate from Makerere University in Kampala, and became, by their standards, wealthy. I can tell you in this country, professors are not wealthy, but by their standards, wealthy. Came back to his village and put up the money to build this library for his, you know, his community. That doesn't happen every day, and so it happened from without. It didn't happen from within. So the fact that Kinta Gesa has a library is really serendipitous. It has nothing to do with that community or really its inhabitants. And that's true for most of the rural community libraries in Uganda. They're started by outside money, and eventually they're taken over and owned by that community. So there's participative ownership of the library, but that's not how they start. So that would mitigate against the argument that there's something intrinsically different between these two communities.
And what's the people who raised him in the town? I mean, not to...
It takes a village to raise a child.
But he was raised in the town. Maybe the people in the town raised him to be more likely to graduate from college and go to and be a... I have a gender question. First of all, did you study gender differences? Are there gender differences in light of what you're saying about the girls doing so much of the work? Are there gender differences in who goes to school more in these villages? Because the girls are needed to do the work, maybe the boys are in it. So, and what's the life expectancy of girls and boys in these villages?
Yeah, we definitely found, this was not this study, but this was based on the previous studies, that the school leaving rate is much higher among girls. Because usually when, you know, they turn 13 or 14, they're really taking over the management of the household and doing all the chores and taking care of all of the little brothers and sisters. So they essentially become, you know, the figurehead or the mother figure.
They could be very curious
right,
and ready to learn.
But have to leave school.
There was one gender difference, I didn't report it, among these learning readiness tasks, the one gender difference was the marble in the hole game. The boys did it for much longer. And I wonder whether if there were a female administrator, whether they would have done it as long, but I think the boys in particular really wanted to impress me, perhaps, as a male. And so they were much more... did it for a much longer time than significantly longer than the girls.
Girls were like,
I gotta
get some water.
Well, they had to go to work.
Yeah.
Longer,
longer. That's true. Yeah. That's true. You know, related to this gender question and going to school and so forth, you want to mention something about the AfroPad project?
Oh, yeah. It's an interesting question. This was... and then we know it's after 2 o'clock.
Go ahead.
Just very, very quickly. just related to gender. There was another research study, also by a colleague of mine from the University of Vancouver, British Columbia, who did. She spent a year doing video interviews and tracking girls of secondary school age, looking at this question of why the school leaving rate was so high. She determined that it's not only because of, you have to pay for secondary school. Mm-hmm. She determined, though, it wasn't only because of school fees, that there were other factors there. And what she found out through these video diaries is that, on average, girls between the age of 13 and 18 miss, on average, about 7 days of school every month because of their cycles. There are no products there for these girls to use, and so they stay home.
And by the time they return back to school, I mean, imagine missing 7 days every single month. There's no way to catch up. And if you saw the schools, I mean, you know, it's just, the whole situation is a nightmare. And so as a result of this study, which was actually turned into a dissertation, some Canadians heard about this and said, this is ridiculous, we can do something. And they started a company called AfroPad. Yeah, and they're actually reusable, washable pads. I mean, not to get too in detail, but it was a solution to a real problem there. And there were no other resources there for this. And so all of the girls in this area, some of them actually worked to make these pads.
So it becomes an economic benefit to the community.
But that was another factor, the gender differences, and so oftentimes these girls could never get caught up and they would leave school altogether.
You know, you wouldn't think about that, would you? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maybe we can recruit some students.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Good luck with the.
So is there a difference between